of the South. Now, do I doubt that the masses of Southern white people, perhaps a majority of them at a submarginal economic level, love the Negro? There are many heartening individual and even group exceptions to that statement. But looking at them as groups, I don't believe that there is yet a sufficient love or understanding for each other among them. The reason, of course, is that behind these two groups lies a long and tragic history. And behind and alongside this sectionalized history lies a human history of many thousands of years in which man has expressed his dislike, his fear, his antipathy for the dissimilar, not only as to color, but as to religion, nationality, and even cultures. And in our part of the country, and these things should be understood as the problem is attacked, this age-old intolerance of the unlike has been aggravated by this peculiar relationship that has existed for more than 300 years. To the white man in the South, speaking in generalities, the Negro has successively represented five unhappy or fearful symbols. First, 75 years ago, property comprising two-thirds of the South's antebellum wealth, which was wiped out as it should have been wiped out by war and removed without compensation. And there was a human resentment then at material loss. Next, a symbol of conquest through the fact of the Negro's freedom itself and his relatively brief period of political co-dominance during Reconstruction, a period that has been misinterpreted in my part of the country in this sense, that we have placed the blame, some of our histories and most of our spokesmen have placed the blame for that tragic Reconstruction period upon the Negro, who was left to bear the burden of the errors and the mistakes and the rest that went on, and not upon the people who came down and directed him in that first period. Next, of course, a symbol on the lowest economic level of competition, of a dog-eat-dog strike for the bottom dollar, and on the highest level of easily manipulated and cheap labor. And finally, of course, a symbol of the psychopathic mistrust of what is known as outside interference because of this concern of non-Southern groups, which is a valid concern, if frequently misled, with the Negro's welfare. And then, of course, linked to all of these is perhaps the strongest and most persistent concept that we have inherited from Western Europe. It's a concept that didn't begin with the slave South and is not confined to the South today, a concept that particularly dominates people of Western Europe and the British Isles, namely that the white race is somehow superior to dark-skinned races, and that the white race must thereby resent and resist any pretensions to political dominance, cultural equality, or social absorption. I don't defend these concepts or the symbols, but I do say that they exist, that they have existed for a long time, and that they're difficult to eradicate by fiat. And obviously the tensions are heightened because the Negro's antipathy to the white man is a corollary of the other attitude. He could not love a people who once held him in slavery, who have consistently kept him in a status of second or third rate citizenship throughout this country, whose concessions have thus far been grudging and slow, and who have made his predicated inferiority the primary unifying factor in their social and political and economic lives. And that's the background, the history, the things that I say people should become familiarized with before or while they are making history. And yet, despite this background, despite the pressure of numbers of dissimilar and largely submarginal groups upon each other, despite the relative poverty, the relative lack of education, and the resistance to change that is a primary trait of rural peoples everywhere, there have been and are being changes in the South that are outstripping the resistance itself. I could stand up here and recite, and I had some cards with statistics. I discarded them because they are very boring things. Statistics as to illiteracy, earning power, and all the rest, including relative justice. But I don't want to talk tonight in terms of statistics. Perhaps it's better to talk in a more personal way, in terms of something I know about, something that may indicate that we are unlearning down there, and unlearning is a great deal harder than learning. I want to talk, remembering this economic factor that is the primary factor involved, I want to talk about one town. It isn't a perfect town, it isn't a rich town, but it's a hopeful town, and I think it's symbolic of the South today. It's a little city in which I live, 35,000 population, which makes it a metropolis there. It's, I think, symbolized in its short history, the history of the South with which we are concerned. It was burned to the ground, every bit of it, during the Civil War by landing parties from Union gunboats on the river. It was ravaged three times between the war and 1900 by yellow fever, which almost wiped its population out each time. It underwent floods almost yearly until 1928, when through the kind of federal interference that all of us approve of down there, the federal government took over flood control on the lower Mississippi and insured us almost against floods. That little town, like all of the South, has had a perilous economic existence for most of its history because it was dedicated until the recent past to one crop, cotton. It has endured thereby the ills to which the agricultural, largely colonial South is heir to, which can be summed up by saying that we have had until the recent past to sell in the open market and buy our necessities in a closed market. But today that little town has doubled its population in the last 12 years, as the South is increasing in many areas its own population. This one-crop agricultural system has been supplemented even down there in that land of cotton by cattle and stockyards, by grain fields and grain elevators, and by the small industries and the large industries that are coming southward, coming to Mississippi, coming even to my town, because there is a great migration of industry southward. And if you all know of any that would like to come down there, we take names after this is over, because we are looking for them. We are actually a part and representative of what can be called a new frontier in this country, a new frontier of economic development as well as a new frontier of spiritual change. Our per capita income is still the lowest in the country, but it's more than double what it was when I came to Mississippi from Louisiana only 13 years ago. All the criteria by which you judge cultures have improved for the better immeasurably in that period. Our literacy rate, our disease rate from those maladies which were most evident in the South, maladies that made people frequently point to the Southern poor white and the Southern Negro and say he's lazy when he was really sick. Malaria, pellagra, tuberculosis, and venereal disease. Those are being brought under control by public health services, and in the case of the first two, have almost been eradicated. Increased income, a larger share of this national dollar that we all battle for, has been responsible for a great deal for probably most of that. And so it is in this little town of mine that the two races do live and are living in relative peace and with less and less the master and servant of the dominant and the dominated approach. We haven't had a lynching or even anything approaching interracial violence there in more than 40 years. In the past year, we had two interracial crimes. It happened that in both cases, white men were killed by Negroes. In both cases, the Negroes went free, one because it was self-defense, and the other because they couldn't find the body of the man whose murder he had confessed. There was no talk of violence or lynching when those things occurred there. The past year, our school board proposed and our citizens voted the first school bond issue we'd had since 1938. $1 million badly needed in this town that's doubled its population. The citizens approved that bond issue, approved it knowing that $650,000 of it was to go to new Negro schools and $350,000 to a new white grammar school on the basis of need. We're building our first hospital down there since 1928, I think it was, $1.5 million hospital under the joint federal, state, and local sponsorship program. That hospital, again on the basis of need, is for Negroes. In the past several elections, I have told you, the vote has not been an issue. They are voting in increasing numbers and without molestation. And while we do suffer under a tenant system, there have been added to our landowners in that county of ours in the past 13 years more than 500 independent Negro farmers, many of whom are using the tenant system themselves. I list these things because they're indicative of what's happening to and in the South as our income increases and our people are resultantly become better educated, not only in the three R's, but perhaps in the meaning of basic democracy too. And this progress, though it is slow, has been steady and has been achieved despite the opposition that you mainly know of and that becomes a part of your headline rather than the progress that is achieved. It's true of the South as a whole, not of this one town, despite the action of some of our politicians and those news stories on your front pages. And thinking in terms other than economic terms, thinking in terms, lastly, of this thing called bigotry or intolerance or discrimination, I want to remind you first that bigotry and discrimination, remind you again, are not exercised against one race or one group of people alone. And so, as part of that spiritual change, the attitudes that I know are changing there, I'd like to tell you just three other little stories about my town. For the past 2 years, the Catholics and Protestants in that town have united to raise something like $10,000 each time, voluntarily and without pressure, for the United Jewish Appeal, for the small Jewish community of perhaps 1,500 people who couldn't raise themselves a quota assigned. And so it was that Catholics and Protestants raised over one-third of that quota for these fellow citizens of ours, and that doesn't happen in a great many places, I don't think. On the other hand, our Jewish citizens and our Protestants are now raising, through the medium of my newspaper, some $30,000 to give our Catholic fellow citizens to help them in their drive to build a new parochial school, and I don't think that happens throughout the country. And finally, in a drive that we conducted under the sponsorship of a Protestant church organization, the Protestant Church World Services, to get food and clothing and implements, farm implements for people overseas, the first and largest contribution of clothing we got came from the chairman of the United Jewish Appeal, a merchant who stripped his store to give us 150 overcoats, and it was filled by members of all faiths. The barge that we filled with this food and clothing and so on was filled by members of all faiths and both races there in the South. It reminded me of a letter that I got, all this that I'm telling you and know that is happening, of a letter to the editor that we had just the other day before I left home. It came from a woman who was obviously a neurotic. She wanted her name in the paper and something about her in the paper, so she wrote a letter in which she listed in great clinical detail a number of ailments that she had suffered from the time she was a young girl. And she said that she'd been listening to the radio about a week or two before and had heard one of these quack faith healers over there from Del Rio, Texas, I think it was, saying that he could help her. So she had written this Reverend so-and-so and told him her condition, and she said in her letter, "I got a answer within a week," in which she obviously gave her the word. She said, "As a result, I was cured on Saturday, but I never noticed it till Monday."